From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. The Samoan community is still reeling from last weekend's unrest on the island of Savi. At least 50 police had to be deployed to stop dangerous fighting between groups of young men and boys from two villages. Two suspects were later handed over to police and have been charged with grievous bodily harm. Sarah Viatulu reports.
Samoa police say the fighting stemmed from an argument that allegedly began during an alcoholic drinking session. The fighting between the two groups later spilled into Savai'i's main market during its usual busy Saturday business hours. Women had safety concerns for their children, as online video showed storeholders and customers being terrorized, with tables and chairs being thrown. Video footage on social media also showed a man pointing a gun to the head of a man from another village who was among those beaten up. A family home at Saletangaloa was also reportedly burned down, and another property left stoned with broken windows and bullet holes.
Look at all this mess. These kids have trashed all the storeholders' things, and no one knew what is going on with these youths, but people's food they were selling has been thrown everywhere.
We don't feel safe in our house. We heard gunshots and rocks were thrown through the house and our car shot at. I said to them, why are you involving us in this?
Public movements were restricted after roadblocks were put up as extra police were deployed from Apia to help local officers. Police Superintendent Aupa'a Longotino Filippo said two men aged 21 and 36 are understood to have featured in video footage of the unrest in circulation on social media and are in police custody in Apia awaiting a court appearance. Our correspondent says local businesses have been left thousands of tala out of pocket from the damage. Otangavaya Tibi Otangavaya says it will have a huge impact on tourism as the fighting leaves people feeling unsafe.
People are just condemning what they saw on the video, and especially what they did, you know, blocking the road and church ministers from those two villages trying to calm things down. And you can hear the background of people throwing rocks, people swearing, and gunshots. And so it's not really painting a good picture of Samoa.
The weekend brawl has prompted regional calls for efforts to maintain peace among Samoans. The Minister of Pacific Peoples in New Zealand, Alpito William Seal, says the fighting reflects on Samoans as a collective. He says it's disappointing that the news comes when Samoan language is being celebrated in New Zealand. Alpito says that this week's theme is kindness given, kindness received. According to him, it is everyone's responsibility to curb violent behaviour, especially among youth.
It requires patience, it requires constant reinforcement of our culture and language as a strength. And so when you go back to the theme, Alofa Tunei, Alofa Maitai Au, it just reinforces that what we're seeing in the island is ways that go back as practice or the behaviour of a bygone era that doesn't fit modern-day society.
A commissioner for Samoa's inquiry into domestic violence is alarmed at increasing violence within communities. Tangaloa Tele Peggy Fairbairn Dunlop says that it signifies a breakdown in the family and village structure.
You know, inter-village rivalry is still hot and hard and can flare up. You know, there's just that whole big thing between legal laws and village honour.
Tangaloa Tele says fighting, guns, throwing rocks with neighbours does not adhere to core Samoan values of love and respect for each other, something many Samoans take pride in.
The vow between brother and sister and brothers looking after sisters and, you know, harmony in families and harmony with other families and, you know, reconciliation, things are not good.
Any whanga or traditional apology has already taken place in a bid to end hostilities between youths of the villages. Some of the businesses affected are seeking compensation. This is Sarah Voitelatu.
It's election time again in the Cook Islands, and the Cook Islands Party under Prime Minister Henry Puna, which has run the country for the past 8 years, is staunchly defending its record. Its policy director, Vane Wichman, told Don Wiseman they will ask the people whether they want political reforms and will work to improve opportunities for people in the outer islands and try to spread the economic benefits of the growth of recent years.
The Cook Islands Party believes that one of the most important things is locking in the economic empowerment and prosperity agenda throughout not just what is currently here today in the Cook Islands, but particularly in the outreach towards the Pa'inua.
When we talk about economic empowerment, what does that mean for the average Cook Islander?
Opportunities to be able to access basic and improved services and goods throughout the whole of the Cook Islands.
You believe that that's been happening over the past 8 years?
If you look at the growth rate, you'll find that it's consistent with growth throughout, but we have to lock it in now. We have to look at the various policies which have not been dealt with, for example, the social cohesiveness ones, the distribution and reallocation of the budget, the opportunities to invest a little bit more and a little bit more smarter in the education and health sectors and in those special areas, well, we say like the vulnerable areas where that type of population needs to be highlighted more.
All right. Going back years, there have been calls for political reform, and there was this document produced about 20 years ago that laid out a whole series of things. And I know just in recent days you've had some forthright comments on that document and just the amount of reform that your party has actually undertaken. So do you believe that there are still reforms that need to be done?
Seriously, Don, every election that has come through since the political reform document was printed in 1999 has picked it up as a football and then left it aside. If you understand that context, then you understand what the Cook Islands Party really needs to do going forward. It's easy for the other parties to say, oh, we're going to take it. But I've seen it over and over again. I was part of the team back in 1995 to 1996 that set the economic reform package here in the Cook Islands. And back then, we were the ones that mounted the commission of this particular report with the three distinguished characters of Short, Herman, and Krogan, the late Krogan. Back then, you would say that we hadn't had a run yet with how the economic reform package would hit back into our systems, our economic systems, as it has done today. So with all due respect to the honourableness of the report, it's well overdue for not so much another commission, but let's give it back to the people now, because over the years, over the last four elections, you can see that it's just used as a political football by everyone. The Cook Islands Party is clear that we need to be serious with what the people really want today. It's easy to say just cut back on seats or to increase representation in these areas, but we're getting a lot of young voters coming through and a lot of the other special sections of our population are coming through. Their views may not have been heard back 30 years ago. So that's the statement we're saying. But in saying this statement, the Cook Islands Party is also clear that we pulled out three very important recommendations from that report because they were well overdue. They were probably something that you can do very quickly and have implemented it. And one of the most significant ones is the Pa'inua Local Island Government Act of 2013, which transfers back more say in the resource budgets on island by our Pa'inua. These are the first steps in the long-term vision of the Cook Islands Party to ensure the economic prosperity is enjoyed right throughout Cook Islands. Now, you've got to be aware, too, that capacity building doesn't just pick up overnight in the Pa'inua and come along with the delegation of authority and so forth. And this is the area where, like any good parent, they still carry or hold the child as they make sure that they know what they're doing with these legislations and with these budgets.
In terms of protecting the Outer Islands, because they continue to suffer so many problems that have been going on for many, many years. What specifically has the Cook Islands Party got in mind?
I've lived 2 years out in the northern Cook Islands, Penrhyn. I would say the vital issue that once it's addressed, everything else falls into place is the issue of isolation. Isolation not just in the access to services, but isolation also in terms of those services being delivered to the island. We need to address the internal shipping of our islands, particularly in the north. And the government, our Cook Islands Party government already in the last 2 years has begun to develop the partnership with private sector shipping companies through to these northern Cooks, to the extent where management contracts with the ships will be able to, at least on a regular basis, provide that opportunity to reduce the gap.
So, for instance, in terms of shipping, you believe that's going to steadily improve?
It has to. Without the vital connection to these islands, no goods, and especially goods, can get out there, nor can we develop those island goods to bring to the main market here on Rarotonga and overseas. We've also got to try and be more innovative in the way we work with our paenua in terms of the current technologies involved in marketing and e-commerce, in terms of trading some of the authentic women's crafts, raw materials and so forth in our paenua, and making sure they are integrated and engaged in our major income-earning sector, which is tourism.
Life expectancy world rankings show Fiji has the highest death rate from diabetes in the world, with 188 of 1,000 fatalities being attributed to the disease. The head of the Diabetes Fiji says the ranking highlights the magnitude of the problem and the need for a more productive approach. Jenny Meyer has more.
Project manager Viliami Gio says people are shying away from medical attention and treatment out of denial, and so when they do come forward, they have more severe complications from their illness. He says there needs to be more community education about diabetes, and many people turn to traditional healers for help first, which also delays effective treatment.
We have three amputations that takes place in a day in a major hospital, and the main reasons is people are presenting late. They come very late. They're not coming early. So we want to get people to be educated that they have to seek medical attention first before they resort to other traditional method or herbal method.
Viliami Gio says diabetes is the leading cause of disability in Fiji, and people need to heed the public health messages about poor eating habits and sedentary lifestyles. Dr. Jone Hawira is a Fijian surgeon and says the diabetes crisis is becoming more widespread, now affecting people in rural areas and at younger ages.
Just last week, we amputated half the foot of a 30-year-old Itauke female. It's not only the rate that's increasing, it's also the age group that's involved with the amputation. And that means we have a big disabled and non-productive population. The economic impacts that's going to make for us is huge.
Dr. Hawira says he's part of a group of frustrated, demoralised and under-resourced health personnel working at the bottom of the cliff, trying to deal with the ongoing diabetes crisis. He says there are many factors affecting the rate of diabetes, including issues like food security and climate change, and policymakers must do more to turn the crisis around. He says diabetes is a physical manifestation of social issues, and preventative policies need to address these.
It's preventable, and that's the hope that we continue to have. We know that it's preventable. A lot of these deaths are preventable. A lot of these complications, like amputations, are preventable. We are trying to improve our education and our awareness, making people really understand what diabetes is and what causes it, and the many ways that they can prevent having the complications once they have it.
Dr. Hawira says he would like to see diabetes education get to a point in Fiji where people are prevented from getting the disease in the first place. Viliami Gio says both education and early detection are vital to dealing with the crisis.
The very important thing is that you get screened, and secondly, that you adapt a healthy lifestyle, especially the eating habits. Our diet have been transiting from traditional food to very fast food, and with this fast food comes sedentary lifestyle. We need people to be very health cautious, to be mindful of what they eat, and be physically active.
Fiji's Ministry of Health says one in three Fijians has diabetes, and there is a higher incidence in Fijians of Indian descent. It encourages regular health checkups and says symptoms include frequent urination, feeling thirsty and hungry, fatigue, blurry vision, and pain in the hands and feet. This is Jenny Meyer.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Female Pacific police officers have valuable skills that should see them appointed to high-profile roles. That's according to the first ever female police commissioner serving the UN mission in South Sudan, who is from Fiji. She has been in charge of a force of around 15,000 officers from 42 countries, and says she is proud to have been appointed to the role, not only as a Fijian, but also on behalf of women from the Pacific. Usira Butem Mudfizika spoke to Tim Glasgow.
Of course, it has been one of the aim in my career to at least reach this level in terms of serving in the United Nations mission. But then again, I did not foresee at the start that it will be at this level. Since it has come, it has been very satisfying indeed, not only for Fiji, but also for the women in the Pacific as well.
What prepared you for a role in a country like South Sudan?
Apart from my 32 years experience that I have had in the Fiji Police, what also propelled me forward is the fact that I had already spent 1 year in the mission here in South Sudan as an ordinary individual police officer. When I came in as a contingent commander for Fiji, where I was able to serve in the front line of the mission.
At the moment, women make up 1 in 5 officers in the force, and you've said that you would like to lift that number. How do you think the lack of women in the force at the moment affects the policing work that you do?
Well, we have almost or even more than 50% who are females and the children, the vulnerable groups that are within the protection of civilian side. And what we deal with on a day-to-day basis in as far as their sensitization programs, in as far as their awareness of their own safety and security. These are some of the roles that are largely conducted by female officers. Having more women really provide us that service delivery that is really relevant to the people that we serve. Not only that, we also support the national police, whereby the women officers, the more numbers that we have in the mission, also provide that opportunity where we can empower and support the female officers.
What kind of an example would you like to set, or what kind of message would you like to say to other Pacific Island women?
First, I would also like to acknowledge the fact that I have been one of the pioneer women police officers in this initiative in the region, which is the Pacific Island Chiefs of Police Women's Advisory Network. It has been this empowerment program that I would like to pay tribute to. So in addition to that, for Fiji, it has been a mainstreaming agenda, that activity that has been a whole-of-government approach as well. All these activities that we have in the region really can empower our women to challenge us for the position such as what I am into it right now. Because when we come into the international policing platform, what we have already done in the region can support us, and we can bring that with us in terms of experience.
One of the experts speaking at this week's New Zealand Emergency Management Conference has had a lot of experience helping Fiji improve its systems to cope with disasters. Save the Children's Mara Patel has worked for many years in many countries as a technical advisor in education and disaster risk reduction. She told Don Wiseman her focus is on assessment, mitigation, and being prepared to respond.
Well, I think what we've learned collectively over the time I've been involved in this field, about 20 years or so, is that, first of all, we need to take an all-hazards approach. That means it doesn't matter whether the next thing to hit us is a tropical cyclone, an earthquake, a volcanic eruption, or even whether we're coping with the slow sea level rise and coastal erosion. The principles of this are the same. I like to explain it in terms of doing assessment and planning, physical risk reduction, mitigation, we call it, and being prepared to respond. Three different areas. And the reason I like to do that is because each of them is important and we don't want to miss out on any of them.
Are we talking here about this is what governments should do, or this is what the NGOs should do?
We're talking actually about all of the above, because what we're talking about when we're using that kind of an approach, it works at the family and household level, it works at the community level, the workplace, the school, as well as at local government and higher level government. They all have to do the same things in their own sphere of influence and jurisdiction.
In Fiji, you've been working, I think, particularly with schools. So what is it you've recommended there?
It's been a wonderful process in Fiji because they're very much dedicated to making schools safe for children. And our goals, of course, are to minimize any deaths or injuries in schools and to support educational continuity, because what you don't want is to have schools interrupted by this, that, or the other hazard impact every year for 10 years of a child's education. So in Fiji this time around, we've been working with the Education Management Information System to build in a school safety self-assessment process that's going to be a two-way communication. So rather than just collecting data from the schools, the moment that they've submitted their information about their hazards and what they've done to reduce their risks, they get a report back giving them recommendations of what they could improve on and how to do it.
A lot of the NGOs and many of the governments that work in the Pacific would say, and I think they could say legitimately, that they just don't have the resources to do a lot of this work.
Well, you know, our focus is on capacity development. I mean, it doesn't work well if you just go and help out a few schools this time and a few schools next time. It's just a vicious circle and a drop in a bucket and the hole is bigger than what you're putting in. So because we focus on capacity development and have a great respect for and understanding of what they've already put into place, we're having some wonderful results at scale.
What sort of response did you get in Fiji to the work?
Well, so in Fiji, our little project came in initially to demonstrate some work with 30 schools. And almost immediately, the government of Fiji said, well, we'd like to do this for the whole country. So let's design this for all 1,000 schools. And then on this trip, they told us, well, we're going to be supporting the government of Vanuatu to do this in the Vanuatu Education Management Information System. So whatever we've been able to support them with to put into place is going to have ripple effects in other countries that, you know, weren't even on the list of results for us. So there are ways to do this, to plan it and do it at scale.
You are here in New Zealand, I think, to take part in the New Zealand Emergency Management Conference. What sort of things are you going to be talking about there?
I'm very honoured to have been invited to contribute on child-centred risk reduction and school safety. So I will be talking to them about some innovative ideas for how we can do, just all of us do better next time. You know, all of us have learned a great deal from the New Zealand experience, and it's not lost on us the tremendous amount of risk reduction work that goes on in New Zealand, the tremendously long recovery time it takes from an earthquake like Christchurch. And so it becomes really important for us to have these partnerships, global partnerships, really, to keep our eye on what's possible. You have a national treasure in New Zealand that most people don't know about. It's called Health Songs International. And as a wonderful singer, and I hope he'll be on New Zealand radio, he knows so much about music from different countries that he can actually write songs in the local music style of anywhere. And what he does is train other songwriters to get them on board in writing the songs and leading children in songwriting for saving lives.
When you look at something like the volcanic eruption in Vanuatu at the moment, which has been going on off and on for 8 months and has got steadily worse over the last couple, and there's been this talk of a possible complete evacuation of an island where you're completely uprooting communities. If you were coming into that at a later stage, how do you go about disaster risk reduction there?
At a later stage, you're always chasing your tail, aren't you? I mean,
well, except you've got a problem that's continuing.
It seems to be a long-term problem, and the same kind of thing is happening in Hawaii. And volcanic eruption is one that we just don't have a huge amount of experience with, do we? Because it's infrequent and it's incredibly unpredictable. But we do know at least some basics about how to prepare for those less intense impacts that are happening all the time. Let's just say knowing how to protect your water sources and being prepared to protect your water sources immediately. Or having your respiration gear so that you can breathe. Or knowing your evacuation route and how you're getting out. Knowing where you're going. I mean, these are all things that have to be done ahead of time. So I would say, you know, one of the things that's always handicapped us in disaster risk reduction is that all that list of things that we have for after the impact, all of it really has to be done ahead of time. So it requires a great deal of forethought.
The Pacific Environment Journalist Network says it's important for Pacific journalists to report on environmental matters in their own backyards. The network was officially launched in Tonga recently as part of the 5th Pacific Media Summit. Former Fiji journalist and now Tongan-based media consultant Issa Tora was elected its president. He spoke to MTT about the new network.
It's a network where we hope we can bring in all journalists who are interested to write on environment, climate change, ocean, and who want to be part of the drive to generate more environment stories. Not only that, to develop environment reporting in the region.
Because I guess it's really important for Pacific people to write about what's going on in their environment, and by doing that, they've also got control of how that story is written and where it goes.
Yes, which is you've stated a very important point there. It's, you know, we have control of how we tell the story. In saying that, we realize that there are a lot of challenges that prohibits most of us from writing environment stories. The one is the fact that most journalists in the region write almost everything. You know, we write on sports, we write on everything else. And then in the newsrooms, most of the newsrooms, environment stories, environment bits are something that is still now in the back room. So with some of the partners that we hope that we can approach, and with Internews and EJN, there are opportunities where we can solve some of those issues. There are story grants, there are training opportunities, there are opportunities where they can also pay expenses to be able to send reporters to the areas where you are not able to go to because of lack of funding. So, and we're very excited about that for everybody in the region to come together, journalists, regional organizations, NGOs, who all work on environment issues, to come together and let us coordinate so that we are able to present a stronger story, stronger messages, so that people out there who still doubt the effects of climate change, the effects of bad management of our environment, can get the real message and say, yes, this is happening. It's not a fake. I mean, for example, President Trump still believes climate change is a non-issue. You should go to Kiribati, take up the president of Kiribati's invitation to visit Kiribati, the Marshalls, Palau, Nauru, even Tonga here. They're starting to see the effects. So these are stories that we need. If we are networked and we are coordinated, then we are able to present a stronger stand, and the messages get out there to people.
And what it does also is that you build a good, strong database and create a really strong network of journalists who know what they're doing. And if other journalists do come from outside, you've got that network, you've got the contacts, and you know what's going on.
Yeah, and I mean, that is something that we would eventually like to. So if people come from outside to come into the region to come and cover stories on the environment, they would be talking to us, liaising with us. And we can work with them in making sure that they tell the story as it is, you know, and so people get to know what is really happening.
And that's all we have time for in this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address, of course, is very simple. pcjmedia@gmail.com. That's pcjmedia@gmail.com. Also, let us know how you heard the program. If it was on medium wave, shortwave, FM, or satellite, or through whatever means, even the wire of the internet, we'd love to know. Until next time, friends, I'm Keith Perrault wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.